Vielen Dank, Rektor Magnifique, sehr geehrter Herr Professor Marc Schies, sehr geehrter Herr Professor Nolte, verehrte Frau Jering, liebe Studentinnen und Studenten der Humboldt-Universität, Exzellenzen, meine sehr geehrten Damen und Herren. Grüß Gott. Ich habe 9 Jahre in Bayern gelebt, deshalb kann ich kein richtiges Deutsch und werde Englisch sprechen. Thank you. I'm very pleased to be back here at Humboldt University. It has a special place in how things happened in my life because I was invited to speak here in 2001, or I spoke here in 2001 as part of the Europe series kicked off by Joschka Fischer, and I gave I guess what, looking over the speech, is the most Federalist speech of anyone, which got some people paid attention to it here and in sort of the western half of Europe. No attention whatsoever in Estonia. It was published in an academic journal. No one read it. Until 2004, when it was dug up and used to attack me as part of the European parliamentary elections, I was such a bad federalist, and all the other parties went on a sort of Eurosceptic campaign. And so they beat me with this article that I had given. But fortunately, it turned out that, as Frau Jering pointed out, Estonia is one of the more pro-European places. And in the elections, I got 3 of the 6 mandates that Estonia has. Thanks to being such a pro-European. So the Eurosceptics failed. I got into the European Parliament. But the difference between Germany and Estonia is that for a large country, being in domestic politics is more interesting. For a small country, European politics actually carries much more weight than you would think. In any case, thanks to Humboldt, I ended up being president. But let me get on with it. Apparently now, only in the autumn of 2008, can we begin to fully appreciate the importance for Europe's security architecture that on both sides of the erstwhile Berlin Wall, we all, new and old members of the EU, old and new allies in NATO, expended so much effort to enlarge and consolidate the extension of the zone of democracy and democratic countries and market economies. For my country, the goal of what I would call the restoration generation of politicians and civil servants was to reestablish an Estonia that is democratic and liberal, a member of the EU and NATO, a goal that if we look at the post-Cold War world, did not turn out to be as self-evident as we might have thought it would be. Alternative choices at the time of the fall of the wall were many. That today we can, those of us in the European Union, all appeal to common democratic values, that we instinctively feel and recognize the values of the Enlightenment, freedom in speech, expression, and association, the supremacy of law and justice, of human rights, is rather an exception in the nations subjected to communism and who came out of it. It suffices to look around us to see the possibilities. We could, as some did, of course, have chosen among a myriad of alternatives. We could have been a neutral, pragmatic, small country, which some in the business community has always called for, and which culminates, as it ineluctably must, in semi-independence. In the worst case, in a state philosophy that all is for sale. In other words, a country not created for the Lockean protection of its citizens and the rule of law, but rather as a guarantor of rent-seeking behavior for some. Or we could have turned into a xenophobic, nationalistic, and therefore isolated, autarkic, and semi-authoritarian state where what matters is power, its possession and preservation by any means, along with all of the material benefits that accrue from that power, as has in fact transpired in much of the post-Soviet world. Or we simply could have become a corrupt post-Soviet state where all that counts is who and what you pay, not justice, not the law. It is, of course, no surprise that we can sense in the deeper reaches of Estonia's and wishes and realities all of these tendencies. In Estonia, in its pre-war or 1.0 version, we experience these more than we would like to admit. Rather, it is a wonder that beginning with the reestablishment of our country, that is to say, from the beginning of the Republic of Estonia version 2.0, we have managed to tame, stifle, block, or divert those same tendencies away from liberal democracy. When we examine the fate of countries liberated from communism, we must admit that the number of liberal and open democracies based on rule of law and respect for human and civil rights has not turned out to be overwhelming. Two decades ago, when I read Francis Fukuyama's original essay, The End of History, and sent a copy to then Soviet Estonia, believing it needed to be read, and if possible, published there, there reigned a general optimism in the inevitable Hegelian victory of liberal democracy. Today, looking at the rise and success of authoritarian capitalism and petrostates and the mechanism of preserving the power of corrupt elites as a completely viable alternative to democracy, my optimism seems rather naive. But the widespread success of those non-democratic alternatives show me, at least, that the choices made in my country were the right ones, at least from the point of view of the Estonian people. But it needs to be stressed that these choices were not self-evident. Ladies and gentlemen, a country's foreign policy always has difficulties escaping its past and its traditions. Thus, for example, the U.S. has considered the propagation and or defense of free markets and liberal democracy a cornerstone of its foreign policy and even of its wars for some 200 years. It has been used to justify the Iraq operation as well as the participation in World Wars I and II, as well as the enlargement of NATO, not to mention the invention of the notion of self-determination of nations by Woodrow Wilson 90 years ago. Russia also has its traditions. It makes no attempts to hide its admiration for the Soviet Union, yet at the same time considers the Tsarist State Chancellor Alexander Gorchakov, who lived between 1798 and 1883 and born in Estonia, as its foreign policy father. Traditions are hard to shake. Russia's recent behavior in international relations can be best seen as a return to its 19th century roots. President Yeltsin's attempts to shift Russian foreign policy toward a more contemporary Western mode is considered in the resentment-powered policy thinking in today's Moscow as a humiliation, as an exception forced upon it in a moment of weakness. The huge change that inevitably follows from Russia's regression to its own historic version of empire, which existed under the Tsars and was revived by Stalin, is what we are upset about. To quote Edward Lutwak, not Lucas, it is the Russian goal seems to be based on a tacit bargain. The Russians accept authoritarian rule and the loss of personal freedom in exchange for an imperial role in the global scene, which starts with the near abroad, with countries such as Georgia, which used to belong in the Soviet Union. But all of this does not mean, of course, that a nation's foreign policy traditions cannot change over time. Cataclysms and changes in the life of a country, first and foremost, defeat in war or occupations, have left its mark on virtually all of the countries in Europe. Or we can also notice that completely different experiences can lead to the same foreign policy results. Compare, for example, Sweden's and Finland's neutrality and opposition to NATO membership. In Sweden's case, it is a 200-year-old policy dating back to an anti-Napoleon alliance with Russia, through which Sweden obtained Norway from Denmark and ceded Finland to Russia. Thus, this established a policy of never participating in armed conflicts except in a peacekeeping role. Whence comes also Swedish neutrality and its opposition to NATO membership, for it is extremely difficult to change a foreign policy principle of 200 years. The same tradition has also allowed Sweden to maintain a high moral profile in foreign affairs, expressed in its opposition to the war in Vietnam, its role as a sanctuary for refugees from Latin American authoritarian regimes, but also in Carl Bildt's principled role in the withdrawal of Russian troops from the Baltic states in the early 90s, not to mention Swedish position on the Georgia-Russian war. In a word, Swedish neutrality stands on a long, strong historical and moral foundation. Finnish opposition to NATO membership, on the other hand, comes from a much more recent foreign policy tradition, born in the winter and continuation wars of 1939-1944, and more importantly, subsequent events, the loss of territory, reparations to the aggressor, conviction in court of their democratically elected president and government ministers, and the overall sense that Finland had been abandoned. Thus, Finland became a pragmatic, non-aligned country, a tradition followed to this day, and that finds a moral or values-based foreign policy difficult to follow. So what are the forces? And we notice that their net result is the same, but the reasons for having an anti-NATO policy are completely different between Sweden and Finland. But what are the sources of Estonian foreign policy? Indeed, not only Estonia, but the sources of foreign policy of a number of so-called new European countries. In general, when Estonians talk about foreign policy, you hear them talk of the trauma of quiet submission to Soviet occupation in 1940 as a result of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and they talk about the legal continuity of the state. Personally, I do not think that these are the sources of foreign policy thinking, though legal continuity of the state is undoubtedly a foundation of what we have done in general. Far more important to my mind is the understanding held to this day that the paucity, or should I say in more contemporary parlance, semi-managed democracy in Estonia in the years 1934 to 1940 led my country into a dangerous isolation. There was far more sympathy for Finland under Soviet aggression than for the three Baltic states, since Finland was considered fully democratic, while the democracy in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania was viewed as less than complete. It was not authoritarian, but it wasn't that great either. This is hardly unimportant, even today. In 2008, Georgia receives part of its support from the West because Russia's demand for regime change flies in the face of the legitimacy of the Georgian government and the Georgian people's democratic choice, especially considering that those demanding regime change cannot come close to Georgia in democratic legitimacy. Our own experience with the primacy of democracy and the consequences of insufficient democracy meant that support for democracy and democracies elsewhere became a cornerstone of our foreign policy. We can have it no other way. In other words, Estonian foreign policy, since its beginnings already before the re-establishment of independence, has been value-based, something for which domestically, for both domestically and abroad, supporters of a pragmatic foreign policy have criticized Estonia for almost two decades. Yet from our point of view, and based on our history, Estonian values-based foreign policy, support for democracy, market economies, rule of law, etc., is as much a pragmatic and ineluctable approach as some other countries' studied silence in its relations with a stronger neighbor. Estonia's experience, its isolation as a result of imperfect democracy in the 1930s and its abandonment more generally, makes it extremely difficult, even impossible, to abandon solidarity with those countries where those same values and the underpinnings of our existence as a state have come under threat. We can call this the Reverend Niemöller principle. As you probably know the poem. It is fundamental, and that is why it is odd to read journalists and diplomats talk about the three Baltic states' knee-jerk anti-Russianists. Those people simply don't get it. It's about democracy. It's not about Russia. Our experiences with joining the EU and NATO only strengthen this tendency. The EU demanded fulfilling the Copenhagen criteria, which demanded that countries that join the EU be rule-of-law-based democracies. NATO, too. For although it had in 1950 taken Salazar's Portugal and tolerated military coups in Turkey, at the end of the Cold War, it became far, far more demanding and value-based than it had ever been before. In other words, pragmatism for Estonia is not the antithesis of a value-based foreign policy. Pragmatism and a value-based foreign policy in my country go hand in hand. In today's foreign and security policy environment on our continent, the antithesis of a value-based foreign policy is realism, realpolitik, that defines the limits to which we can apply to values, to international law, and to justice. The differing paths and responses that follow from realpolitik versus values create the tensions that exist in the national foreign policy of a country like mine, but actually it creates the same tensions in every country in the European Union. When do we stand up for values, for principles such as territorial integrity and the impermissibility of the use of force to change borders? And when do we understand that nothing more can be done or that doing something begins to harm our own interests? These are the questions we ask all the time. This is precisely the tension between remaining true to one's ideals and true to the fundamental task of the Republic of Estonia, but which is the fundamental task of any state, is to defend its own people. This defines the framework in which foreign policy workers must work day to day, from event to event. For like it or not, we still live in a world where not all share the fundamental values of Europe. But I'd like to get a little more theoretical on this issue. 10 years ago, I was asked to give a public lecture on how it was that Estonia had been invited to begin negotiations to join the European Union when our southern neighbors had not. This was in 1997. I said then that in foreign policy we have a choice to derive satisfaction from stating some important historical truth only we ourselves fathom, showing some other country what's what, or instead suppressing this impulse and to achieve what we need to accomplish. I said that this was, and for a number of countries, remains a challenge that is faced by the East European countries released from communist bondage. With some exceptions that have more to do with size, those countries that in the name of national interest have chosen goal-oriented behavior and strategies have been the winners in foreign policy. Those who have instead insisted on proving themselves right have had to discover the sad truth that at the level of nation states, such notions as justice have little purchase. You can see justice and right in a well-functioning domestic legal system, but in interstate relations rarely. More often, alas, might makes right. Which is why at the threshold of the third decade of foreign policy in Estonia version 2.0, we need to think about the role of justice and right, just as we need to do so in the European Union. The intellectual foundation of the European Union, leaving aside, of course, the internal market, although even that is part of the same foundation, is Immanuel Kant's essay, Perpetual Peace, from 1795. A century and a half earlier, the Westphalian Peace Treaty of 1648, with its principle of cuius regio, eius religio, had largely eliminated religion as a casus belli and established the principle of sovereignty and non-interference in internal affairs, but it did not prevent future wars. Kant believed already then in our contemporary foreign policy mantra that democratic states do not wage war on each other. Kant believed that only representative democracies based on the rule of law brought together in a federation of free states can live in peace. Pressing the historical fast-forward button 150 years ahead, we reach Monet's and Schumann's vision of the European Union, precisely a Kantian vision. This is where Estonian foreign policy and the broader European idea intersect, at least in theory. The EU is built up on common values, the understanding that all pragmatic or practical issues can and must be resolved through negotiation, concentrating on the, quote, process. And when that fails, we at minimum will have the least common denominator, which is reached by consensus or qualified majority. The primary goal of Estonian foreign policy version 2.0, joining the European Union, has given one possible solution to the dilemma of all small states: how to survive among the strong, how to survive among the big. The aim of Estonian, as well as EU foreign policy, is to achieve a Kantian perpetual peace between representative democracies tied together by mutual treaties and the rule of law. This is what we actually mean when we use the, alas, overused expression that the EU is ultimately a program of peace. The problem in all this is that if you are not tied to the system, if you are not bound by rule of law, then the Kantian solution simply doesn't work. When we deal with countries that recognize neither the rules nor the norms of international behavior, even when they're tied to a system, say the OSCE or the UN or through a PCA, the framework simply no longer operates. Then all that counts is force, that might makes right. Instead of Immanuel Kant, we have Thomas Hobbes. There is nothing new in this dilemma. To the contrary, throughout history and long before it, this has been the norm. And this is where I get to my title. The second history book that is known to our culture, Thucydides' Peloponnesian Wars from 431 BC, in a chapter familiar to us as the Melian Dialogues, describes what happens to the weak and the small when the rules do not apply. Melos, a small island that had declared its neutrality in the Peloponnesian War, was approached by the Athenians, who wanted the Melians to submit to them. The Melians asked for negotiations to maintain their neutrality. The Athenians answered they had a right to rule simply due to their superior force. 2,000 years later, we would begin to call this Machiavellian, after Niccolo Machiavelli, for whom the fundamental question of politics was the effective use of force in order to increase one's power. Here, there is no place for morality or justice. But to return to the Melian dialogue, the Athenians informed the Melians that the question of right applies only when both sides have equal power to enforce it, that the strong do what they can and the weak do what they must, in that most famous expression of foreign policy. The strong do what they can and the weak do what they must. In other words, in the absence of an agreed-upon system of rules, when there is an imbalance of force, all that counts is might. We have seen the same today. We see the same today in Darfur. We see it in Georgia. In many ways, the doctrine of mutual assured destruction of the Cold War is the same principle, that you cannot have an imbalance of force. The Melians appeal that the supremacy of might could someday come to haunt the Athenians as well when faced with an even greater power, but the Athenians answer that not to use force would expose their weakness and thus decrease the Athenians' own security. In the end, the Athenians offer the Melians a choice faced by too many small nations of Europe through history. Submitting, you will avoid the worst and remain alive. The Melians decide not to give in to pressure. The Athenians kill all the Melian men and enslave the Melian women and children. 70 years ago in September, if you weren't a foreign policy official, you probably didn't pay much attention to the developments in Munich, where Adolf Hitler and Neville Chamberlain were carving up Czechoslovakia, where, according to Hitler, the Czechs were violating the rights of the German population. Returning to London, Chamberlain declared he had achieved peace in our time. The dismemberment of Czechoslovakia, he justified, stating, it is but a small, faraway place about which we know nothing. Most of Europe had no clue as to what was about to happen in 1938. But presently the paradigm changed. The act of carving up Czechoslovakia changed the rules of post-Versailles Europe. We don't know today if knowing ahead that the paradigm had changed would have helped anyone, but we must recognize that we too have just witnessed a cardinal paradigm shift in the foreign and security policy architecture of Europe. We just had gotten used to the idea that the post-Cold War world had become Kantian, where the only serious security threats were Islamicist terrorists waging asymmetric war, and who moreover lacked the necessary tanks, bombs, planes, and other attributes of Westphalian statehood. And suddenly, in August, we discover that the rules, which means no use of force to change borders, and our assumption that the rules would now apply in all of those areas of Europe where the history supposedly had ended, that those rules don't apply. And what we have seen is the collapse of what has been called the post-1991 settlement, the sort of general view of what we had achieved after 1991. What is this post-1991 settlement? Fundamentally, it was that the borders of 1991 will remain and that any changes will be negotiated as stipulated in the Helsinki Final Act, and that the use of force in Europe is not acceptable. There was an implicit division of labor. Russia would have a free hand on its own territory. We would not really say anything about Chechnya, but the rest would be taken care by the West through its own institutions. It was believed that a post-ideological Russia would have nothing to do with authoritarianism, suppression of human rights, repression of dissidents, and especially not with the use of force beyond its borders. The assumption was that it was merely a matter of time before Russia became something like France or the UK, just another liberal democratic free market European state that neither attacks nor bullies its neighbors, something that was done only by the bad communists, but not by Democrats. and who, thanks to its ever-deepening embeddedness within the system of rule-based organizations of the older democracies, would also become yet another member of the Kantian world of perpetual peace. This Fukuyaman understanding of the post-1991 settlement came to be the basis of NATO and its erstwhile 16 member states, and led to considerable soul-searching within NATO itself, to the point where one-time Cold War hawk Richard Lugar, in his Foreign Affairs article 10 years ago, titled it, "Out of Area or Out of Business," an expression coined by Manfred Werner, arguing that the disappearance of a threatening and dangerous Soviet Union and all that was entailed by that, the defense of the Fulda Gap and the Gyup Gap, if any of those terms mean anything to anyone these days anymore, but all of that all disappeared. And the only way to keep the alliance intact was to deal with challenges outside of the traditional space of NATO. Enlargement, were there to be one, would be simply to further bind new democracies, but there would be no contingency planning, no building of defense infrastructure, because we had achieved our Kantian hopes. There was no need for a NATO in Europe. From 1991 to 2008, which was the period of we already look back upon as the period of the post-1991 settlement, there remained a fundamental assumption in the European Union and NATO that post-Cold War Europe is forever free from the ills of the 19th and 20th century history of industrialized wars between industrialized states with their millions and millions of victims. States had matured, learned that the use of force was at worst something tin pot autocrats in the Balkans would do in Europe, but that this did not threaten the general well-being of our continent. True, here and there were steps back. Perhaps an election in one or another state was not quite as democratic as we would have liked, or there were some questionable domestic practices. But the fundamentals of security architecture were in place. States had the right to decide for themselves where they wanted to belong, be it the EU, NATO, GUAM, the CIS. And if they met the entrance criteria, they could join. The idea of spheres of influences was mercifully dead and buried. For Estonia and the rest of the new members of NATO and the European Union, this is really the only paradigm we actually know. Because at least as countries that decide on their own and by themselves, I mean, sure, we knew the Cold War, we were victims of it, but we did not, countries that actually decide what they do, we only know the post-1991 settlement. We only have made decisions where we know no one's going to attack anyone else. There will be no aggression. That's all we know. And there is no one left alive, actually, who was in a position to decide before World War II, when it was the last time we could decide anything by ourselves. So we don't quite know how to proceed. Not that I think anyone else does. After a hiatus of half a century, when we began to participate in the CSCE, later the OSCE, as entities with our own position, when we negotiated our entries into NATO and the EU, and then began to take part ourselves in the decision processes within the European Union, it all has taken place in this post-1991 paradigm. On August 8th of this year, this paradigm collapsed. The post-1991 settlement collapsed. Neither the European Union nor NATO, not Estonia or the UK or Germany or France or the Czech Republic can possibly understand the nature of this change yet. Is it possible to continue with a values-based foreign policy in NATO and the European Union? What does a pragmatic foreign policy promoted by some member states mean for our future policies? If, in the name of pragmatism, we shut our eyes to the behavior of a large neighbor, what does it mean for our policy regarding the rest of the world? Does a European Union that wants as quickly as possible, in the name of doing business, to get back to business as usual and ignores aggression, does this union stand a chance of developing a foreign and security policy that is not a joke? Can a common foreign and security policy that is nothing more than the least common denominator, where there's always a possibility of doing a separate deal, does that foreign policy stand a chance? No one wants to think that a Kantian paradigm of perpetual peace that we all keep in mind when we talk about Europe perhaps no longer works. And we certainly don't want to think about the Melian dialogues. We are, however, in a brave new world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, President Ilves, for an impressive speech which makes us all think. President Ilves has agreed to take a few questions for 10 or 15 minutes. And after that, there will be a reception out there. But before, let's give you all a chance to react to what President Ilves has said. Anybody wants to ask a question?
It's okay. No reaction? Good.
Well, he has told us we should forget about all we thought was true in the last 18 years of European and NATO foreign policy. I think that's worth a question.
But I explained it so well.
Yes. Please.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Alf van Staden, University of the Netherlands. I'm just a tourist here in Berlin, but I was struck by this wonderful invitation. Mr. President, I would like to thank you for your very thoughtful and, in many respects, thought-provoking speech. It seems to me in the university background it was very appropriate to listen to so many references to political thinkers from or to Thomas Hobbes and also come from Eeuwigen Vrede, World Peace. But it seems to me that the main point you are making that about Russia. Russia has embarked on policies going back to the 19th century. And of course, that's raising the question what sort of policies the European Union should pursue Russia. Of course, it takes some courage being in Germany to make the case for some sort of containment policy. I don't know whether you had that in mind, thinking. About, but we are in a very sensitive stage, of course, as far as the relationship between European Union and Russia is concerned. Last July, we started off a new round of negotiations on the new PCO, Partnership and Cooperation Agreement. Because of the events in Georgia, we have, with many good arguments, I think, we have decided to suspend the second round of negotiations. But right now, after the successful intervention of the EU presidency towards Georgia, there are many countries in the European Union who are in favor to take up the second round. So my question would be, what is the position of Estonia? And if you were against taking up the second round of negotiation, what sort of alternative you could recommend to us? Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Well, first of all, you cannot talk about containment in a globalized world. It just doesn't make sense. You cannot contain anyone if they're participating in the world economy. So I think Kennan-like thinking does not apply or doesn't lead anywhere. We should think about George Kennan, who in that same long telegram said about the Soviet Union, but calling it Russia, said that Russia thinks it can only have as its neighbors countries that are vassals or enemies. And it seems that, unfortunately, that still seems to apply in the way they view its neighbors. And now, concretely on the issue of Georgia and the PCA, we follow the position of the Council of September 1 that when the six-point plan is met, we will continue with the PCA. Our problem seems to be, at least to read the speech of the presidency and of the commissioner in Strasbourg, is that we are willing to go back on the September 1 decision and, in fact, continue with the PCA negotiations even when the six-point plan points have not been met, being withdrawal of troops. We have the continued presence in the Al-Khodori and the Khodori Gorge, and nothing has moved at all on the IDPs or internally displaced persons. And so those aspects of the agreement have not been met. And I think that's very dangerous to actually have a policy where you make an agreement and then you decide that, oh, well, those things don't really count. I think that leads precisely to the wrong kinds of behavior and the wrong kinds of interpretations. More broadly, I would say also that I think we have to rethink the nature of the relationship, because I don't think the assumptions that held before August 2008 hold today. Take one example. Part of the PCA, though not explicitly a part of it, but part of it, with that is included the continuation of the visa facilitation negotiations leading up to full visa-free travel between Russia and the European Union. Now, I maintain that the European Union is complicit in what happened in Georgia by offering a visa facilitation program to Russia, but not offering anything to Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, Albania, at least for a long time. Now it's catching up. The problem is, to my mind, fundamentally in the approach avoidance policies, little I remember of psychology, but the approach avoidance conflict in dealing with the neighborhood states. We don't want to give them too much because they might want to become members. So we give them a little bit, but not much. And we give them less than we give to Russia. And if you were Abkhazian or Ossetian, and you're a Georgian citizen, and you have no possibility of getting through to visit the European Union, and then someone says, but here, well, so what if you're not Russian? We'll give you a Russian passport. And on top of that, you get into the EU much cheaper and much easier simplified policies. I mean, why is it that people have been taking out Russian passports in countries where they're not Russians and that are not Russia? So I think we bear a certain responsibility here. I am not really that interested, however, in making the PCA the fundamental issue. I think the PCA negotiations should continue when the conditions are all met, as was agreed on September 1. And secondly, more importantly, I think we should pay much more attention to the neighborhood countries. And just by way of explanation, to touch on all bases, one of the reasons why Estonia and many other countries were strongly supportive of giving the membership action plan to Georgia in Bucharest was that because of the utter failure of the neighborhood policy, which, as I said, was based on not giving anything to those countries, exemplified by the press secretary of President Barroso changing his words when he visited Ukraine, when he said that Ukraine has a European perspective to Ukraine's geography means that it is part of Europe. I mean, if you change the meaning of the words because you don't want to even give the idea that you might someday become a member of the European Union, that I think is indicated by what, I mean, it is holding those countries away that led us to say, well, if nothing is being done for these countries, at least the membership action plan, which we went through, is a very effective mechanism for actually very intrusive non-Westphalian sort of tinkering inside the mechanisms of states. And you could say directly, change that law or forget NATO. You know, this is undemocratic. This is, you are doing this with the press that's wrong. You can say all those things in MAP, and you can help these countries along. MAP never meant and does not mean automatic membership in NATO. You could be in the membership action plan for 20 years and still not be there. But it was a tool that we thought was useful. Not giving that tool, I think, was interpreted the wrong way in the East as a signal that it is part of, there is a draw de regard. It is a zone of influence. And so that's a long answer to your long question.
Any other question? Yes, please.
I came together with my economic students. I'm not from the Humboldt University. I missed some words about economic position in your country. And what do you think, if you are now thinking about a little bit domestic questions, what are now the advantages of Estonia economy, the advantages, your comparative advantages? And while I carefully listened to your speech, I understand, I came back now from Tallinn, from a conference, I understand your very critical position towards Russia, I understand it. Nevertheless, you are neighbor countries. Are you see any perspectives in the economic cooperation? I know that are very, very in this field, but what is your perspectives in this field? And I see bad perspectives now. What is your opinion in this field? I will not know tell about stories which I have heard in Tallinn, you know this, but your perspective positions, what can Estonia bring in division of European labor? Thank you.
Well, frankly, the economy right now is stuck in its first cyclical downturn. We've had downturns before, but they were not cyclical. The first downturn came when we became independent, but that was not cyclical. It was just that the economy died. The second time was in 1998 due to exposure to the Russian economy, but that was not cyclical either. This time it's cyclical, and part of it is also we actually started suffering before the downturn that we're in for other reasons, but which were fairly inevitable, which I think is a problem of all converging new member states of the European Union, which is that the competitive and comparative advantage of cheaper labor has not been sufficiently offset by a rise in productivity. That's the problem of Portugal. That's the problem of the new members. That was the problem of Portugal, not the problem of Portugal now, but it was the problem of convergence, rising labor costs. I mean, everyone is happy because they're living better, but they're not producing more. And that's going to lead to major restructuring in the country. I mean, what I would like to see, more of is, we have a group of very bright young men. They invented Kazaa, and then, of course, they were indicted by the U.S., and then they went and invented Skype. And so we have 350 people, most of them from the rest of the world in Tallinn, coming up with new Skype products. That's one direction to go. There is no competitive advantage for the Estonian textile industry, because we used to have one, but there is none anymore. And so that's a serious problem, and this is what every converging economy has had to go through. And we're going through it, and where do we go? I'm not sure. I mean, certainly I would like to see much more, more high-tech companies. I mean, we have, one of our inventions is paying for your parking tickets on your mobile phone, because instead of looking, as I remember, I had to do in München, sort of going to place and putting in your then Deutschmarks and getting a piece of paper and saying, see, I paid. You just do it on your mobile phone. And we've been selling that, or the company that does this has been selling this to Brussels, Antwerp, and I don't know where else. I mean, there are creative high-tech solutions that you don't have to be a big country to do. Other economic issues, I mean, certainly we are blessed, at least for the next 40 years, with complete energy self-sufficiency, but it's very dirty. It's oil shale, but which allows us to be completely independent on energy. But that's, I mean, as I said, it's dirty. We don't like it being dirty, and we'll have to come up with some solution on that. We'll see what happens with what we do in this economic situation with the agreed upon carbon reduction schemes, because they may suppress the economy perhaps too much. I'm not sure what will come out of that. So, I mean, we're a small country. Where, in fact, if you come up with something creative, you can actually change the economy around fairly quickly. But also, if you do the wrong thing, you can go down fast. Did that answer your question?
Mr. President, I would like to abuse my position to ask you a question too.
Please.
And to come back to the topic that you were talking to us. We are at a university, and at universities we try to challenge ourselves and to play the advocatus diaboli. And I would like to ask you a question. I'm an imagined defender of Russian policy. And as an imagined defender of Russian policy, I would say Matryoshka on my mind. Matryoshka is the puppet which you open up, and there are always more puppets there. Now, the smallest puppets is the South Ossetians, which see perhaps the Georgians as the Athenians in the early 90s. The Georgians are a small puppet which see the Russians as the bigger puppet, as the Athenians, where they are the millions. But the Russians see themselves as the smaller puppet because they are the Americans, who are the even bigger puppets. And depending on which puppet plays with which puppet, the question of which is the bigger puppet becomes difficult. Now, according to, I think, the majority of independent sources, it was Georgia which attacked Russian peacekeepers, which were there legitimately, legally so, in South Ossetia. So that is how it started. Now, it may be possible, and maybe I reveal myself as a narrow-minded lawyer, that there are grand schemes out there of new paradigms. But I want to relate the new paradigms to the facts as we have seen, as they have been reported. So if you accept this as the advocatus diaboli question, I would be grateful to hear your answer. Thank you.
Well, I mean, the justification, I mean, I don't believe in analogies as a tool for foreign policy, but the Russian side does. And I mean, the analogy was to Kosovo. In fact, in Kosovo, it was a result of long-term genocide in which and long negotiations that ultimately led to this outcome, not a blitzkrieg, which is what happened. Now, the question of who attacked whom is really, I would say, it's more like the village in Poland. I mean, in the village in Germany on the Polish border on September 1. I mean, technically, probably, yes, it seems that way. But I mean, if you've been bringing, you know, you don't move 7,000 tanks in 2 hours. You don't do it unless everything is prepared. You don't have ships full of armored APCs and tanks that have left the harbor in Sevastopol already several days before, ready to unload all those on a railroad that you have repaired with railroad troops in the month of May. So, I mean, nor shall we forget the complete silence by the UN, the part of the European Union, on the missile attacks already a year ago in August when Russian planes came and shot missiles at Georgians in Georgian territory. So, I mean, okay, The question is, I mean, technically, it may even turn out that the first shot, I mean, sort of going into territory, was the Georgian side. But that doesn't change the situation. I mean, it was, because it was Georgia. It is not Russia. It is not, I mean, the point is, were it to be, where had they attacked Russia, obviously, Russians go attack. They didn't go. They were not attacked. They were on their own territory. So, I mean, the question is basically is that we can argue, we can talk about the fine details. The point is, what we have seen is naked aggression and the change of borders via military force. That is the rule that has been changed. I mean, we can look for justifications, and I mean, I accept that people will justify it. But soon as you've broken that principle, then the game is over. I mean, the rules no longer apply. Nothing counts anymore. Once you say that you can, in fact, change borders with a blitzkrieg, now new borders, new countries, over. I mean, that's where we are. And that means the fundamental assumptions that we have based our foreign policy thinking on and our security policy thinking. It is the basis of the peace so-called peace dividend, the fact that Germany's contribution to the NATO budget or to military expenditures as required by NATO was so low, it comes from the peace dividend. There's no need, there's no threat. Unfortunately, we have to rethink these things. At least we have to rethink.
Thank you very much. Now we have... would you take two more questions? Yeah. And I think then we go and to the reception. There's the microphone.
Mr. President, we have been knowing each other for a long time. I remember in the 90s at NATO. I always had a discussion with President Mary on whether you should be more perspective or whether you should not be too pessimistic, only looking at the present times. My question to you is, can't you see as perspective, and what would be your answer in creating a kind of strategic concept to bind in Russia into Europe? You know very well that we are in the way of a process which started in 1990. I need not to remind you of the 2+4 treaty and the regulations in it, deployment of combined NATO forces, even in the eastern part of Germany, are concerned. I think we always have bestowed much hope on your membership in the European Union as well in NATO as finding with us the right way to create a process of stabilization for the whole of Europe, not only the European Union. And I think we have not done our homework very well. We need to ratify the Lisbon Treaty for this to make the European Union stronger. But don't you have a long-term perspective what our common relationship with Russia is concerned? Thank you.
Mm. I suggest that we take the second question and you have the last word. There was a gentleman in the back.
Yeah, my name is Matthias Hübscher and I have one question. About this, Mr. President, you mentioned that the European Union is first of all a union of democracy and European values. My question is, does this count even according to Turkey in your point of view or on the Estonian point of view? Is this the first issue or can this become a second important issue due to strategic reasons and the links to America that it's going back in the second row, this democratic and European value issue. Thanks.
I'll answer that first and then I'll come to your question. We are very strong supporters of Turkey because we think that All reasons to exclude Turkey are wrong, except for that it is not democratic. I mean, it is part of Europe. It meets all the criteria, if it meets the democracy criteria. If Turkey or any country goes back, then the process stops. I mean, we can say in many ways, Estonia slipped into Slovakia's spot thanks to what Mečiar was doing. I mean, that's what happened in the 1990s. Ambassador Shumkin can assure me that's true, right? I mean, that's what happened. Countries slow down, they move back, and then but the European Union is flexible. It's okay, you know, you do this. I mean, you know, the question of Law 301 is very important. I mean, the regulating freedom of speech or freedom of the press. And I mean, if that's when that's changed, then we move ahead. And if they go back, then we stop. I mean, that's the way we went through it in the European Union for years and years. So I think it's a process and we'll get there. Now on the issue of binding security agreements and the Russians, basically security is about whether or not you're going to send your son to war or go yourself to war to defend something. Ultimately that's what it comes down to. I mean, clearly sitting around and having a discussion is nice, but when security is, are you willing to send your children off to war? And frankly, I do not see democracies sending their children off to war to defend non-democracies. The ultimate decision of going to war, aside from self-survival, why you would go somewhere, is to defend values. And we don't, unfortunately, share common values with Russia today. Maybe in the future it'll change. Maybe in the future they will respect freedom of speech. But unfortunately, right now, what we've seen from Chechnya, I didn't even mention Chechnya as in terms of self-determination, but that's a whole different issue I don't want to get into. But, I mean, if you look, I mean, no one is willing to defend the security of Russia that is of a government that does not respect the rights, the fundamental rights that European Union and NATO are based on. And so, I mean, aside from a talking shop and a sort of a new OSCE, which is fine, but ultimately is toothless because it's based on consensus and, I mean, it's a nice place to talk, and it's probably very good that we sit around and talk. But it does not guarantee security, and I do not see a overarching security arrangement having any genuine function. I mean, with the kind of force that you have in NATO, that, okay, now we go and do this, if participants in it do not share the fundamental belief in democracy, rule of law, a Rechtsstaat, in the human and civil rights. I mean, let's face it, it's not going to happen. And I don't think countries are willing to participate in something where their children might go off to defend something which is not democratic. Pessimist, I know, but...